Are you constantly trying to drink more water? Because same. I feel like I literally never drink enough, even though I try so desperately. I have been using a hydro jug, which is a half gallon jug. They have cool little colorful sleeves. They're really fun. But if I don't fill that sucker up first thing in the morning, I don't drink any water. So I fill it up first thing in the morning. I drink it throughout the day at work. I come back home, I refill it up and just drink as much as I can. And truly, it's the only way I'm successful, and sometimes that even fails. If you're looking for a new large water bottle that is not a Stanley cup, look no further. HydroJug has given me my own discount code for you to go get 10% off anything on HydroJug. Their website is www.thehydrojug.com. HydroJug is HYDROJUG. And my code is COLDBREW, all lowercase, COLDBREW. So if you're looking for a new, efficient way to drink more water, I highly recommend the HydroJug. I am a HydroJug believer, so you can go get your HydroJug at thehydrojug.com. Use code COLDBREW for 10% off. It was a cold December night that Rhonda Henson spent celebrating at an office Christmas party. To everyone's surprise, it would be the last night Rhonda would spend alive. You're listening to Cold Brew, a true crime podcast fueled by Cold Brew Coffee. I'm your host, Caitlin Brewer, and if you like what you hear, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can find me on social media at Cold Brew Crime to see images related to this episode. I know. It has been way too long. If you are new here and this is your first episode, I used to be a stay-at-home military spouse on the deserted island of Hawaii, but now I am a full-time working mom who does not live in Hawaii and has no time to make a podcast, clearly. But I am here today with a fresh episode for this new year of 2024, and hopefully some newfound motivation and consistency. You guys are truly the best and have always encouraged me and continue to encourage me, and you're just sticking around, even if I'm not. I hope this episode finds you all well, and truly, thank you for still being here. Okay, so for this episode, I would like to give a quick thank you to my neighbors at DT's Blue Ridge Java in Spruce Pine, North Carolina, for generously providing me with a cold brew for this episode. They are a family-owned coffee shop located on Locust Street, aka Lower Street, and it is really always kind of been one of my favorite spots in Spruce Pine. They are super passionate about community and supporting local, and they do an excellent job of promoting that, and you do feel very welcome as soon as you walk in. They serve breakfast and lunch, and I don't think I have honestly ever been there for lunch, but I often go for breakfast. They have tons of coffee beverages, treats. They even have coffee beans in stock in multiple flavors that you could purchase to take home. And I love to get the Becky's breakfast sandwich. It is so good. I don't know who Becky is, but she knew what she was doing. It has hot deli ham, peppered bacon with melted Swiss cheese, lettuce, tomato, a delicious honey mustard on a combo bagel that they make in-house that is just so delicious. Now remember, I like my cold brew black, but DT's makes this sweet foam that you can get on top of your cold brew. And if you like your coffee sweet, it is for you. It's super good.
Today, I'm actually pairing my cold brew with this little like productivity shot I've been taking for a few weeks now. It is pretty fun, to be honest. It is this little like 2 ounce, I'm shaking it up, sorry. It is this little 2 ounce like shot. It's packaged really cute. And it's green, and it tastes like, it's really sweet, but it's matcha flavored. And it's supposed to help like your mental focus and relax you, but while also increasing your productivity. I've definitely noticed a difference. I feel like it really like makes me less hyperactive, so I can actually sit and focus on the tasks that I want to be doing and not looking around my whole house or office trying to find a task to accomplish quicker, if that makes sense, because that's my problem. I want to go do something quicker than the task that I really need to complete. This is called Magic Mind, and it tastes like matcha, which also helps boost your energy. That's your flavor. And then it has adaptogens that help you relax, and nootropics. That's what keeps your mind focused. I don't know much about those, but seems to be doing the job. And it has some immunity boosters in it also. I've been taking it in the mornings with my normal coffee, but today I'm obviously taking it with this cold brew. Yeah, I've really been enjoying it. You can get your own productivity shots if you visit www.magicmind.com/JanColdBrew. So that's Jan Cold Brew. Again, that's www.magicmind.com/JanColdBrew. And you can use my code, which is coldbrew20. That's capital coldbrew20. This code is for January only. You're going to get 1 month for free when you're subscribing for 3 months on their website. And then my code's going to get you an extra 20% off that for a total of 75% off. So that's like a pretty dang good deal. So this is only valid for January. So you have about 15 more days left to use my code. Again, the code is coldbrew20, and that's at magicmind.com/JanColdBrew. So the case that I'm so eager to share with you today actually found me several years ago at this point, as my husband and I were driving back from Charlotte on New Year's Eve in 2020. Let that sink in. It's 2024. Literally, that's so long. I noticed a large white banner with red bold writing on it, mounted between these two trees at the top of a bank, like off on the interstate. We were driving on Interstate 40 from Spruce Pine to Charlotte, and the banner was like, I'm going to say exit 112 westbound, for those of you who like directions. I don't. I just know exit 112, either direction. The exit, I believe, was for Mineral Springs Road, which is like on the way to Hickory, close to Hickory from Spruce Pine. So the banner read in big, bold capital letters, "Who killed Rhonda Henson?" I literally was like, whoa, okay. I told my husband, Brian, I said, did you see that? Obviously he didn't, because he was driving and not looking for banners on the side of the interstate. I immediately started Google searching and retrieved numerous articles about her, with her face, pictures, everything, her story, all of these miscellaneous theories about what happened, and even realized that her case was featured on an episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I was like, whoa, how did I not know this? And if I did know about this, why did I not remember this immediately in my mind? So I had a lot of questions. I feel like I would have remembered it. I feel like I should have seen this banner before, but I hadn't, none of it registered in my mind. I basically went on a spiral for like 48 hours and researched everything I could find, watched all the videos I could, read as many articles, and I still don't know what happened. And I'm here to share Rhonda's case, her unsolved murder, and I hope you listen, because we still don't know who shot and killed Rhonda Henson after 40 years. Rhonda Annette Henson was born on December 13th, 1962. She was the first child born to Judy and Bobby Henson. When Rhonda was 3 months old, the new family moved from Great Falls, South Carolina to Valdez, North Carolina, which was about a 2-hour drive, and it was to be closer to Judy's brother.
In 1968, they welcomed a baby boy, Robert Jr., or Robbie as they called him, to their family. Upon moving to Valdez, Bobby, the dad, had taken a job at Waldesian Bakeries, which is where he would stay for the remainder of his working life. The first few years of the family being in Valdez, they lived in several different homes until finally they landed at Hillcrest Street, which is where Judy and Bobby still live today. And for those who aren't familiar with this area, let me share just a little bit about it. Valdez is a town in Burke County, North Carolina. It's roughly a 1 hour drive from where I live and about 20 minutes outside of Hickory. In the 2020 census, the population for the town of Valdez was 4,689. It's a very unique little town in the foothills of western North Carolina. They take great pride in their traditions, specifically that of the Waldesian settlers. It is surrounded by tons of nature, from rivers to waterfalls. You can do just about any outdoor activity you can think of. I've only seen it in passing, but again, it looks super cute. Rhonda attended Valdez Elementary School before continuing to Valdez Junior High. She was a good student who excelled at sports, playing tennis, basketball, dance, track, and baton twirling. She was also part of the junior varsity band. She played clarinet and continued to do so in high school, where she attended East Burke High. She was well-liked and is remembered for always smiling and laughing. Rhonda's neighbor, Sarah McBriar, told reporter Larry Griffin, quote, "Rhonda was well-liked by everyone. She made friends easily, she didn't carry grudges, she smiled and laughed, and was always in an upbeat mood," end quote. Most said Rhonda had it all, and during the end of her high school career, she even had the boy. Rhonda started dating Greg McDowell in the fall of both of their junior years. Greg was an accomplished student and a mediocre athlete, but a likable guy by most. The couple appeared to be a perfect match. After Rhonda's death, her mom Judy would later share letters and cards sent to Rhonda from Greg with investigators. They were cute Hallmark cards from all holidays, lengthy letters, flirtatious note cards. Judy found roughly 25, give or take. But when you read through the letters, it was easy to see a shift between the two, especially the letters written by Greg. Greg would state things like, "You better not flirt with customers at work," and "You better act happy to see me after school." Been there. Very overprotective and jealous tones came through in the letters. Judy expresses that she felt like her daughter was happy with Greg in the first years of their relationship, but near the end of senior year, she noticed Rhonda's attitude towards the relationship turn cold. Several friends and family members had also noticed a behavior change in Rhonda. Her cousin Christy told the Record journalist Larry that, quote, "Rhonda became less talkative. She usually was very chatty, always having something to say, and her word choices tended to be less optimistic and, though not exactly dark, tended toward the dark side. That just wasn't the way she typically talked," end quote. Senior year brought prom, graduation, senior trips, and parties. But by the end of the school year, the letters to Rhonda from Greg suggest that the relationship was becoming more toxic than one would like to admit. Comments leaning toward both physical and emotional abuse were evident. After graduation, Rhonda and her parents agreed it was time to get her a new car. She had been driving a 1967 white Volkswagen Beetle, and she called it Snowball. Rhonda was usually the driver in her friend group. Several of them mentioned in interviews the strict rules Rhonda had when you were riding in her car. She would not start the car until all passengers were buckled and the doors were locked, stating that she was almost OCD about it. Her parents also added that on top of being a very safe and cautious driver, she would always call her parents before driving home. She wanted them to have the porch light on and to be expecting her. A lot like she really did not want to be left outside alone in the dark for too long. In the summer of 1981, after Rhonda had been working at the Tasty Freeze for several months, the Hensons agreed to trade in Snowball for a tan 1981 Datsun. This was just a cute little two-door car, perfect for Rhonda, and she loved it. Rhonda's mom said she was proud of her car, and she was super proud that she was making the payments. It wasn't long after the car purchase that Rhonda got a job as a key punch operator at Hickory Steel, which made structural things out of steel. Betty McDowell, which was Greg's mom, also worked there. Some say that Betty got Rhonda the job, but Rhonda's supervisor said she simply met all the requirements and had the merit for the position. Rhonda really seemed to enjoy her job at Hickory Steel and was really proud that it gave her the financial means to make her own car payments. Over the next several months, through the end of summer and into fall, the Hensons and Rhonda's close friends would notice a shift in her demeanor again, like that she had become very paranoid about being alone in her house and would often call her neighbor Jill to come over if she knew her family wasn't going to be home. She was always very safety conscious, but things were starting to escalate. At one point, Rhonda was routinely sneaking into her parents' room at night and would fall asleep on the floor. She even offered to pay her brother Robbie if he would let her sleep in his room. Something that really began to worry her parents was when Judy woke up in the middle of the night, just a few days before the company Christmas party, to the sound of running water. She discovered that Rhonda was taking a shower. When she asked what she was doing, Rhonda would reply, "Mom, because I feel dirty." On December 22, 1981, Hickory Steel would host their annual Christmas party. Rhonda had been unsure as to if she would attend, but during the workday on the 22nd, she called her mom and asked if she could go buy her an outfit to wear to the party. Judy obliged and picked out a few outfits for Rhonda to choose from. Rhonda had made plans with her co-workers Sherry and Tanya during work that they would ride to the party together. Sherry would drive, and Tanya and Rhonda would leave their cars at Sherry's house. Rhonda would also spend the night with Sherry, so she wouldn't have to drive back and forth between Valdez and Hickory, as they had to work the next morning. Even though Greg's mother worked at Hickory Steel's, the McDowells did not attend the party. Later, in an interview, Betty, Greg's mom, would state that Mr. McDowell had a stomach bug that night. Records indicate that a phone call was placed from the McDowell household to the Hensons at roughly 8:15, but Bobby said no one was on the other end of the phone when he picked up the call. So, it's the night of the party. Rhonda runs home to go get ready. She tries on the outfits that her mom got her, and she just loves them. She picks one, puts on just a little bit of makeup, and then hops in the car to drive to Sherry's house. The girls get to the party, and they have, as far as we know, a great time. The exact time that the three girls left the Christmas party, however, is a little unknown, but Sherry Pittman's mother recalls them arriving back at her house around midnight, and according to her, the girls really did seem to have a lovely time. Just before rounding up to go to bed, Rhonda asks Miss Pittman if she could use her phone to call Greg. Even though this would be a long-distance call, Miss Pittman agreed and said that it was okay. So Rhonda went downstairs to use the main phone in the kitchen, and there was nobody, everybody was upstairs, so nobody was down there with Rhonda when she was making this call. However, Sherry does remember hearing Rhonda say, quote, "I'm leaving to go home now," unquote. Rhonda went to the bathroom and came back, and she was crying. And Sherry remembers that Rhonda made a comment that Greg was super mad. Rhonda's plans at that moment immediately changed, and instead of her spending the night at the Pittman residence, she was going to drive home. At around 12:15 a.m., Rhonda got into her car, and she began the 18-minute drive back home to Hillcrest Street. It would have been close to 12:40 a.m. when Rhonda would have been taking the Mineral Springs Mountain exit to drive the final half mile to her house. At approximately 12:55 a.m., two witnesses reported hearing a high-powered rifle about a minute after they arrived to their home, just off the interstate exit. At this time, Judy Henson recalls having a premonition in her sleep and unexplainably sat straight up in her bed from a deep sleep. Judy says she remembers it clear as day. She knew something was wrong. At about this time, it's assumed that the two men driving down Eldred Street that noticed the beige car in the ditch was just after 1 a.m. They pulled over and walked around to the passenger side of the car, where they saw a bullet hole and blood on the front seat. They immediately got back in their vehicle to go get the police, which they literally had to go find because you couldn't call it that easily in 1982. By 1:15 a.m., an officer was on the scene. That's when they found Rhonda, lifeless and laying behind the open driver's door. Her upper torso was resting against the bank, and her head was propped up against the rear wheel. The car appeared to have been going up the hill and then started going backwards and stopped when it fell into the bank on the side of the road. Before anyone had even identified who this young lady was lying on the ground and found the family as to which she belonged to, Judy Henson was awake, and she knew something was wrong. She phoned the Pittman residence to see if Rhonda was still there, and on the second attempt, Sherry finally answered the phone. Sherry told Mrs. Henson that Rhonda had left to come home, and by this time it was a little after 2 a.m. Bobby Henson decided he would call the McDowells to see if maybe she went to Greg's. Mr. McDowell answered the phone and handed it to Greg. He told Bobby that Rhonda had called him at 12:30 a.m., and Greg assumed she was at home when she made the call. They even called Jill Turner, Rhonda's best friend and neighbor. Of course, Rhonda wasn't there either. But at the scene, the officers observed what was a hole, apparently a bullet hole, in the trunk deck of the Datsun, about 10 inches left of the trunk lock, and that the passenger door was still locked. Inside the vehicle, there were many items, a Christmas gift, a card, a pink purse. They were all laying in the front passenger seat. Other items in the car included a stuffed pink snake, an East Burke letter jacket, and a gray hooded sweatshirt. Nothing out of the ordinary. During the autopsy of Rhonda's body, it would be confirmed that she died of a gunshot wound that was found to the left of her mid-back and that it caused a massive traumatic destruction of the heart and the lower left lung. It fractured the left fifth rib and I'm sure just was absolutely excruciatingly painful. The official immediate cause of death would be recorded as exsanguination, which is severe loss of blood. A large caliber, particularly jacketed bullet with a marker anterior fragmentation was recovered from the body. The Datsun was then towed from the scene to a more secure station for further investigation because it had been raining most of the day since this crime had occurred. State Bureau of Investigation Special Agent John Suttle noted several significant observations. This is an excerpt from his findings. Quote, "There was an oval-shaped gunshot hole in the trunk lid, 10 inches to the driver's side of the trunk lock and beginning 1 inch toward the front of the car from the intersection of the horizontal and vertical planes of the trunk lid. This hole was 1.5 inches long and 1/2 inch wide. Inside the trunk lid, an irregular hole was in a brace. The paint was chipped on that brace, and the brace was dented. The chip is approximately 1/4 inch in diameter." They noted all the other contents of the car. Nothing in particular stuck out, and all were things you would expect to find in a young female's car. There were 2 holes in the rear seat behind the driver. A lot of blood was noted in the left rear floorboard extending into the corner of the seat, which the reporting officer recorded that the blood corresponded to the angle at which the car was found. There is also quite a bit of blood smeared on the driver's seat, keyword here being smeared. The smeared blood indicates that Rhonda was moved and initially shot while in the seat, and then someone dragged her out of the car and deliberately placed her body. Medical opinions would note that Rhonda would very much have been incapacitated with the location of the bullet, so the only explanation would be that someone else pulled her out of the car. One of the main factors left in the investigation at that point was to figure out which direction the bullet came from. Investigators put bracing rods into all the holes in the back of the car and in the seat, one through the trunk and the back seat and into the back of the driver's seat. These bracings indicated that whoever shot Rhonda was parallel with her, meaning they were following her. To summarize the crime scene, Rhonda's car was found, still running, backed into a bank off an exit on the interstate. Her body was lying propped up on the car and her arms deliberately placed by her side. Lots of blood was inside the car and a single bullet hole was found and appeared to have entered through the trunk of the car, gone through the back seat, and punctured the driver's seat, which ultimately killed Rhonda. Investigators first suspected that this was just a random act of violence, or this is just a mere accident. No one would shoot someone like this. But after a lot more investigating, we are pretty sure that Rhonda might have known her assailant. Several witnesses were interviewed and even polygraphed. One specific witness testimony sticks out, and it's that of Reggie Smart. Reggie was leaving Fulbright's garage, where he worked, just 1 mile north of the Valdez exit, right before 1 a.m. He was approaching the Interstate 40 off the eastbound Mineral Springs on-ramp when he noticed a beige car backed into the ditch on the same side of the road that he was traveling, which would have put the headlights shining at him because it would have been the opposite direction. He slowed down and squinted to see into the window of the car, and he noticed what appeared to be a blonde woman slumped over the steering wheel. He also could see that the driver's door was open and the car lights were on. Mr. Smart stated that he saw a white male, roughly 6 feet tall, standing outside the driver's door. He guessed the weight of the man was roughly 170 pounds. To him, it appeared that the couple might have been drunk, and he decided not to stop. Reggie Smart is the only witness to have seen Rhonda inside the Datsun at the scene. On January 8, 1982, a $5,000 reward from Governor James B. Hunt was offered for more information combined with the $5,000 from the town of Valdez and the Morganton Burke Crime Stalkers. That and private donations got the reward up to $20,000 for any information that could lead to a conviction in the murder of Rhonda. By now, 43 years later, the files on Rhonda's case contain thousands of documents and fill several filing cabinets. Although there are a few suspects still to this day, Rhonda's killer has never been identified, and her case remains unsolved. Foreign DNA was recovered from Rhonda's sweater, but has never been matched to a suspect. With today's DNA testing, there might be a higher chance of results, however, that requires funding, which for this small-town sheriff's office in Burke County, that's probably out of the question. Rhonda's case was even aired on Unsolved Mysteries on November 15, 1989, and was actually filmed at the location of her death. Although it brought awareness to Rhonda's murder, no leads were established after the show aired. Judy Henson stated in an interview with Dateline on December 13, 2022, which would have been Rhonda's 60th birthday, that she doesn't know if her daughter's case will ever be solved. Too much time has gone by, too many people passed away, too much evidence has been lost or destroyed. However, a year prior, a woman named Brooke McDonald contacted Judy Henson. She then came forward to the sheriff's department with information regarding Reverend Charles McDowell, which is Greg's father. The sheriff's department has released no official statement on this matter. However, what Brooke has shared could possibly lead to Rhonda's killer. I will continue to follow the story closely and will release updates as they become available. The Burke County Sheriff's Office is still requesting information about Rhonda's murder, as it is still an active investigation. Their phone number is 828-438-5506. There is so much speculation on this case, and I have spent hours reading Larry J. Griffin's articles on the Wilkes Record online, which in total are close to 100 publications. I have left out so much detail that you can find in his stories online. He has been incredibly thorough in questioning Rhonda's family and close friends, even people who only knew her in passing or who realized they were connected to her after her death. I highly encourage you to read his articles if you are looking for a deeper dive into Rhonda's case. I could have shared a lot more of those details, but I feel as if he has said it best. So you can go find his publications on www.thewilkesrecord. Wilkes is W-I-L-K-E-S, thewilkesrecord.com. I would also like to give credit to the Berks County Sheriff's Office, NBC Dateline author Kayani Reed, and the Unsolved Mysteries Wiki website. I would also like to take a brief moment to acknowledge a listener, Casey Cobert. She is from Australia. and she has helped me jot down some facts of the case. Cold Brew is written, recorded, edited, and produced by me. To be sure you don't miss future episodes, please subscribe to Cold Brew, True Crime Podcast, wherever you listen. If you like what you hear, I would love for you to share this podcast with your true crime-loving friends, neighbors, coworkers, family, literally anyone. That would be great. You can send me questions or comments about this episode. You can find me on social media at Cold Brew Crime. It feels so good to be back with you guys. I hope I have given Rhonda's case justice. I know there is so much more that I have not said, but hopefully I'll be back very soon with an update about who killed Rhonda Henson.